Julie Willems, Noble House.
Well, if it's a question or a critique, first of all, thank you very much. But I have a problem with your word intention.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it's my, that's English is not my mother tongue, but somehow if that's the label of the intersubjective space where causation happens, then intention kind of brings my mind back to trying to find out why halva is pouring this on the water. So it's, for me, it kind of sounds fairly similar to motivation. Why did you choose that?
No, it's a good question. The reason I like the term intention is there's two reasons for it. One of them is the phenomenological, philosophical tradition in which one talks about intention not inhering in the actor but in the action. So the question would not necessarily be Halvard's intention in pouring water, but there's certain muscular movements that are going on here. What is the intention of those things? Which is to say, what is the goal to which they strive? What is the public social meaning of those things? Pouring a glass of water is an intentional action. Right? It's entirely possible for Halvard to have made those same motions and not poured himself a glass of water. But it is the fact that those things are unified in a kind of socially meaningful whole which makes it a comprehensible action. Donald Moon did a great bit on this 30 years ago, talking about voting. He said, you know, voting is not simply walking into a booth filled with levers and making certain motions with your hand. It's something else about the broader meaning of those behaviors. And that comes a lot, and a lot of it comes out of that phenomenological tradition where intentionality is located at the level of the action itself. The other one is that there's a group within a philosophical tradition within the philosophy of mind which likes to differentiate between motive and intention. Quentin Skinner does this. You get some of it in JLA Austin. The idea that there is something that goes on inside of the head, and then that there is something else. A lot of this comes out of Wittgenstein, and Wittgenstein never used this motive-intention distinction, but he used a distinction that was very much like it. So you're right that there's an unfortunate vocabulary issue when it comes to that distinction, because intention is often used synonymously with motive. If there are better words and if there's a better way to make that work conceptually, I would be perfectly happy to use it. But that's the distinction as I found it, and so that's kind of the way I've been playing with it. It may turn out to be a bad set of labels, and maybe in the future we can come up with a better one.
He being the socially constituting
right.
nature of the thing.
Right.
Ole Jakob Sending, also of the house.
Thank you. In your article from 1999 on relations of force space, you have a discussion with Geek Substantials.
Yes.
And the example you use is that of changes in the state.
Mm-hmm.
And you critique substantialist explanations because they cannot explain change in the entity itself, because it has to assume that the primary attributes are given.
Yes.
And then there are the secondary attributes that can change.
Right.
But given what you just told us, how does that fit with Weber's concept of an ideal type? Because if there is an ideal type,
right.
doesn't that imply that you have to fix?
Right. No, it's a good. No, it's a good question about. I'm just repeating for the podcast. Is there a tension between ideal typification and the emphasis on process versus substance that I've articulated in other parts of my work? And I think there can be, but I don't think there's necessarily a tension. I think part of the solution to it is methodological. That an ideal type can't actually be a substantialist claim, because an ideal type is of necessity an oversimplification for the purpose of explaining a more complex reality. So I think by making that kind of caveat, one is automatically pulling back from the classic kind of substantialist account in which one is actually claiming to have identified the real essence of something.
And you said that. You said it's an analytic and not a ontic claim.
Yes. Ideal types used, and this is right, but I think that it's insufficient for reasons I'll talk about in a second. I think that it's impossible for an ideal type properly understood to actually be a substantialist claim. Now, properly understood is important because most people don't understand it properly. And the temptation, I think, is not just a personal failing. I think it's also just something that kind of happens with the way we think. We have a tendency, once we've ideal typified something, to start mistaking the ideal type for the actual object. Especially if it's a good ideal type that works pretty well in practice. And we go, yeah, okay, so I have gotten all of the essential components of this. And you have to kind of stop yourself and go, wait a minute. Maybe not. In fact, whoa, I'm not supposed to do that because I'm not supposed to have claimed to have identified something ontologically. So there's a temptation that falls into this. This has been usually studied within the philosophy of knowledge under the heading of reification. People will talk about this as being a problem of reification. And I think most of the solutions that get offered in that literature are kind of silly to the extent that they require you to be a dialectical Marxist in order to get out of it, as if somehow juxtaposing and saying that there's a developmental tendency will stop you from being an essentialist about stuff. I don't necessarily buy that. I do think that thinking configurationally is one way around this. That being able to say that there are multiple ideal types, then it's a lot harder to say that I've actually zeroed in on the essence of something. But there's another component to this, and this is where the intentionality bit becomes sort of important. Because motivational explanation has what Weber would probably call an elective affinity to substantialist thinking. And this has been identified by lots of other people, my favorite being the identification in John Dewey and Arthur Bentley's Knowing and the Known, in which they point out that the mind as actor is the old self-acting soul grown desiccated and crotchety. The idea
being... Can you take that again?
the mind as self-willed actor, I think is actually the phrase, is just the old soul grown desiccated and crotchety. Because the idea of a transcendent essence to the individual. But then, of course, when you get to the mind, well, the mind is just the same notion, except it's been sort of purified and cognitivized. And they say, no, that's silly. Mind is not something that exists inside your head any more than soul exists somewhere in your breast. It's just a weird metaphysics. Focusing on the social, on the intersubjective, on the transactive, I think, and ideal typifying transactional patterns is one, and I think a more significant avenue of getting away from the accidental error of substantialism. Because if I'm not ideal typifying objects that have primary qualities, but instead I'm ideal typifying patterns of relation, and saying, all right, here is a set of transactions that are going on. I've now moved myself out of that sort of temptation. Now, it is possible, especially if you happen to be a critical realist, to mistake your ideal typification about relations for a specification of deep unobservable structure, in which case you're a substantialist about structure. So it is possible to sort of fall back on that all the time.
Aren't you then, if you're ideal typifying a relationship or a relation, mm-hmm. aren't you then falling back into the same problem of primary secondary attributes in the relationship?
If you allowed your ideal typification to become an ontological claim, then yes. But if it's purely instrumental, because the differentiation between primary and secondary qualities is something that people do all the time in their everyday consciousness. This is how we act. We identify things. We isolate stuff. That's kind of what we do. And again, I sort of mentioned the Marxist dialectical solution to this, which is to say, no, you're identifying developmental tendencies, and then you can sort of have this nice teleological progress towards something else. I'm not crazy about that as a way of solving it. But I do think that, when Joseph Lapide talks about the difference between arrestation and reification, that he's onto something, that temporarily arresting an ongoing process for the purpose of doing something is a perfectly reasonable operation. Building that temporary fixing into your analytical apparatus becomes a problem. So I can say, if I'm looking at a group of people who self-identify as members of a given nation, clearly in order for them to do this, they're articulating things about the primary qualities of their nation. Sure, that's what they're doing. But it would be a mistake for me then to take those primary qualities and build them into my account of their nation. And say, no, that's not actually what's going on here. What's going on is a process by which they are differentiating between these things. So as long as I'm focused on that active ongoing process, then I think it is possible to avoid that kind of reification. It's possible to avoid that kind of error. But you're absolutely right to caution about it, because the slippery slope is from an ideal type to an idealization to a substantialist account of essence. And I would like to think that we as a scholarly community could sort of engage in the first without slipping into the other two. Also because I don't know how we would proceed if we couldn't do the first. I mean, I don't know how you would proceed to analyze things if you didn't have concepts.
Other things? Christine Haugvik, also of the house.
Yeah, I guess it's a follow-up to the same, and I'm not sure if I'm following things correctly, but this is something I'm struggling with myself in my own research in terms of, you know, when you develop an ideal type on the basis of empirical observations, mm-hmm. and then you try to do an illustrative case study,
right?
And how do you kind of go back to the tension of either modifying the ideal type,
right?
Or, you know, because... I mean, at some level, any theory would be an ideal type claim, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Because no, in practice, no theory can really explain
right.
anything, because then you're going to be a theory.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. There's a tension between the development of an ideal type and then the use of an illustrative case, particularly if you're using the same case to illustrate as you use to develop. Two things, I would say. One of them is the application of ideal types. This is where the configurational part of it is really important. Simply illustrating that a particular ideal type seems to be borne out in practice is not, I think, actually a piece of ideal typical analysis. To really be analyzing something, you've got to use the ideal type to differentiate in the particular case between adequately causal and coincidentally causal factors and sort of figure out what's going on there, in particular by bringing in more than one ideal type. Think about when Weber has these three ideal types of authority, right? He's got charismatic authority and rational legal authority and traditional authority. And these are different ways in which claims to legitimate authority are cashed out. Except when he actually talks about any actual cases, he's always talking about tensions between them. So you end up with his discussion of the Catholic Church, not in terms of an exemplification of charismatic authority, or in terms of an exemplification of rational legal authority, but as a form of what Weber calls the routinization of charisma. Which is to say, charismatic modes of authority and rational legal modes of administration being contingently and problematically hybridized in an individual instance, which gives you the weirdness of my favorite of the strangenesses of the bureaucratization of the Catholic Church, this very detailed bureaucratic documented process for sainthood. So what you're doing is you're rationally documenting and measuring and coming up and signing forms in triplicate about violations of natural law caused by the superior faith of... How bizarre is this? Because there are forms. I mean, it's a process, a very deliberate, stepwise process to become a saint. And that itself is not explicable either as pure type charisma or as pure type rational legal. It's only explicable as the two and the tensions between them and the way they get worked out in practice. So Weber could use and does use at some points elements of the Catholic Church as an illustration of rational legal. But when he actually sets about analyzing the Catholic Church, it's a combination. So I would say developing an ideal type by looking at a series of historical cases is sort of, that's in one part of the project. And then even if you go back to those same cases, there's more complexity that shows up. And as long as one is clear, the clearest way to do it is, of course, to develop the ideal type with a different set of cases and that have not used them before. But that's often very difficult to do in practice, because if you want to have an ideal type that's kind of nuanced, you sort of want to be close to the data in a lot of ways. I know in my first book, the way I did this was the ideal type of argumentation that I wanted to develop, I used a couple of examples from debates about the Marshall Plan. But then the empirics that I had were about more than the Marshall Plan, so it sort of expanded out from there. So here's a set of debates. Let me ideal typify the positions going on within these debates and the gestures that people are making. And now let me apply it to a whole bunch of stuff. Applying it back to the thing you originally derived it from is going to be much more of an illustration. Pushing it out, okay, now I've learned something else about this. Now I'm able to see something a little bit differently. So, but I think it's important that we be really clear about the difference between the illustration. This is where the neopositivist stuff gets us in trouble, because since neopositivists treat claims as hypothetical conjectures, then you can test an ideal type. And then using the same cases used to develop the ideal type becomes an example of an endogeneity problem, and then you've got to get new ends in order to validate the thing, as if somehow the fact that the ideal type was able to be used in more than one case somehow expands its validity. Weber sidesteps all of that. Ideal types are neither valid nor invalid. They're either useful or not useful. They demonstrate their utility in explanatory practice. So, you know,
or not.
Or they demonstrate it. This is why Waltz could be true but irrelevant, but not false. Which is a subtle but really important distinction.
Which he himself says.
Yes, which he himself says over and over again. Waltz got this.
Morton Anderson.
Thank you. You mentioned the agency structure debate, but parallel to that, you also have the can reasons be causes debate.
Oh, yes.
And the argument against that would be the same arguments you are using for intentional analysis.
Yes.
So what saves causality, then, in your project, would be the methodology of ideal typification.
Yes.
Could we lost here? It was very clear, but I think it would bear with the audience and pose the question again, okay? Preferably in other words.
Martin, can you give us a 60-second summary of the Davidson reasons or causes argument?
Well, the whole debate with the reasons and the causes is basically when you do stuff. If a teacher asks you to do something, raise your arm, and you do that. Your reason for doing that, people would argue then, is probably because of the authority of the teacher and all kind of social arrangements it's possible to do in the presence of the teacher, what you should do and all those kind of stuff. And people would argue you cannot treat those social circumstances as set causes, but actually causes an error from that to you raising your arm. You can have physical processes, you know, that was going on within your arm, but you cannot treat those two things in the same way, basically. So the arguments against the fact that reason can be causes would be the same arguments then for intentional analysis as opposed to motivational analysis. But the causal argument still is outside of the intentional argument.
Right. No, because the argument that reasons can be causes is that my reason for doing something internalized impels me to do something. So it's the argument for reasons being causes is a straight-up motivational argument. Reasons can constitute motivations for doing something. They can constitute sufficient grounds for action. So because I believe that the teacher has the authority to order me to do this, I therefore go ahead and do this. Or because I want to kiss up to the teacher for the day, I'm going to do what the teacher has said. So in either one of those cases, the reason for it is the cause, because it actually passes through subjective consciousness. The philosophical critique of that would be to say, okay, that doesn't make any sense, that the reasons that one gives occupy a very different sphere than what's actually going on internally. And interestingly, that's also the side of the debate. I mean, Weber's not participating in this debate, but it's sort of the side that he comes down on when he talks about the legitimation of political action. He says, people have all kinds of interesting reasons for doing stuff, and it doesn't matter, because what goes on inside their head is much less relevant than the forms with which the articulations of authority and power take. So people can obey. There's that definition of rulership and domination, purely statistical, right? Domination means the probability that you get your commands obeyed. Pure and simple. And he says, there's a lot of reasons why people might obey your commands. And he lists a whole bunch of them. And so that's really not what's interesting. What's interesting are the typical modes into which the justification of your ability to command are articulated. That's where you get into these intentional structures, these intentional organizations of appropriate action. He actually makes the same argument in The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism, where he has that long laundry list about greed. He says, you know, people say capitalism is about greed, except lots of people throughout history have been greedy. And then he goes on for a whole page listing all the different ways in which people have been greedy and the things they've been greedy about. And given that Weber had read everything ever in world history, he had a long list. I mean, he could say a lot of things. And he said, and that's totally irrelevant. What matters is not whether people are greedy. What matters is the forms in which greed is legitimated. What matters is which kinds of greed are acceptable and which kinds of greed are not acceptable. And that's what we ought to be arguing about. So by shifting to that intentionality and by doing this ideal typification, that is precisely about locating causation in a different place and avoiding that critique. I don't need it to go through anybody's head. And I don't even need it to be explicitly articulated, because causality in this approach is about the analyst's ability to, or inability to, imagine things working out differently if you move stuff around. The ideal types help us do this. There's a weird way in which the notion of causality that comes out of this is actually very similar in one respect to the kind of causality that you hear from neopositivists. Causality in this approach is not something that exists in the world. Causality is something that's part of the analytic. Causality is part of the scholarship. Whereas if you're a critical realist, right, causality is real dispositional powers of real things really out there in the real world. Notice how many times I'm saying real, because that's, if you're a critical realist, you do that a lot. Whereas if you are a Weberian, no, causality is something that emerges from the analysis. We can have a causal account of something. But it's not like causality is out there to be discovered. How could it be? If we're using ideal types, shifting around ideal types is going to change the causal account. So we kind of have to be humble about that if we're using this kind of an approach, and not say, I've discovered what's really causal about this. You can say, I have an account in which this causally is related to that. It's an account that lots of people look at and we sort of nod our heads at and say, yeah, that's pretty compelling. But then, as Weber reminds us, you have to realize that other people looking at it with very different kinds of value orientations may come up with a very different kind of account of these things.
So the causality for motivations should be a different kind of causality than the causality for intentions, necessarily, or by choice?
I don't know about necessarily. I mean, I think that the only kind of causality that one could have for motivations would be that internal, subjective internalization. It's possible to cash out intentions in the same way. I wouldn't do it, and I think we shouldn't. I think we should be focusing much more purely on that social intersubjective process. But it is possible. I mean, there's some readings of Mead, for instance, that would talk about these intersubjective processes then sort of taking up residence in an I-me distinction that's kind of held subjectively. This gets us a little bit off track, but I mean, my feeling on that is that we should read less Mead and more Goffman. And it should be much more about performance. So,
well, gravity is not an ideal type. Let's return to...
Oh, but it is. The theory of gravity is an ideal type. It has to be. Nancy Cartwright put it really well in the title of a book, which she called Why the Laws of Physics Lie. Laws of physics are not empirically confirmed in every case. If they were, they wouldn't be laws of physics. They would be empirical observations about stuff. Laws of physics are both abstract and ideal. They take place in abstract logical space, where they're isolated from other things. They make unrealistic assumptions like mass points and things that, like, don't actually have any physical analog, but they work pretty well for getting stuff done. And Cartwright said, if we actually treated the laws of physics as if they were falsifiable hypotheses, we'd have a real problem.
Now we're back to Quine here, aren't we? But
to some extent,
where is the value commitment in coming up with the idea of gravity?
Well, read Nietzsche.
Or Einstein.
There's a whole series of... Nietzsche diagnoses the value commitment involved in a lot of modern science as being anti-humanism. Right? We are not the center of the universe.
But
we're not. I mean, that's sort of the story, right?
That would be preconditions of thinking about
right. How
these emergent, how these ways of thinking emerge.
Yes.
But
yes.
They wouldn't be descriptions of the actual mode of thinking.
I'm not sure. Would it be possible if you were really committed in a value basis to an anthropocentric understanding of the universe, you couldn't really accept modern physics whole scale? You would have to reject it in part. You would have to do different things to its story about... I mean, this is the whole debate about evolution, right? If you really think, if you're really anthropocentric about things, evolution is going to bother you. It has to.
I cave in on this one because there are still people sitting around spending their entire days trying to levitate, so... so, you know, it's an empirical example.
Exactly.
Okay. Let's return to the question of politics. You've had enough philosophy of science for one day. It was great. We have a couple of minutes left. Let's have one or two questions about politics to round it all off.
Okay, start with the guest.
Coletta, please.
Yes. Patrick, you've done a lot of thinking about states and the evolution of states. And I was wondering if you think about state as a process, maybe a transactional process for mobilizing resources, and, mm-hmm. and if you think we have a dominant ideal type, if that makes any sense in social sciences, and your advice for those of us who are trying to do work on states and study states and state interactions, if we should maybe update our ideal type.
Yeah.
On stage.
Yeah.
What do you see out there right now?
No, it's a good question. I mean, as something of a Tilly student, I'm sort of honor bound to talk about the state as at least in part an extraction process. You know, it's sort of one of the things to be a card carrying member of the Charles Tilly Club is you have to say, oh yeah, states, organized crime, check. And I think that there's something very useful in that notion that what we have is these organized processes that we call states have a lot to do with resource extraction, resource manipulation. Something that Tilly never quite got into, but Foucault fortunately did. You know, a lot of this, the business that the state has gotten itself into now has a lot more to do with individual governmentality. There's a lot more biopolitics, different modes of governance that have sort of come in and reactivated these institutions in different kinds of ways. The question about new ideal typifications and different ways of doing things. I mean, if one's going to take Weber seriously, then an ideal type should not be forever. Shifts should, in fact, allow for different kinds of ideal types that speak more to the concerns and value orientations and debates of a different historical time. We get stuck because we think that our ideal types are not actually ideal types, and we sort of get stuck on these old definitions, which we extract. Extracting that Weberian ideal type about the state and its necessary territoriality and so on and so forth, and then somehow saying, okay, that's just what states are. I'm not sure that states are that anymore. And in a lot of cases, the territoriality thing is getting relaxed in all kinds of ways. Think about the regulation of e-commerce and such. I mean, where things are located becomes considerably less important. Think about the kinds of collaborations that you now get between states, not just on sort of the formal diplomatic level, but lots of informal things, the shading off into NGOs. Of course, I'm not going to say much about that because we've got two people in the room who just wrote a book about that. So I think that Ivor and Eliakov's attempt to think about a different kind of ideal typification in which we talk more about processes of governmentality may be more insightful for helping us figure out a number of things about how political authority is configured these days. I think that what the Copenhagen School has been attempting to do, without saying so, is developing a different kind of ideal type of how things become securitized. The problem is they get epistemologically confused about exactly what the status of a securitization claim is, and so they end up treating it in ways that allow as if there was a yes or no answer to the question, is something securitized? And I think that the better question here, if we're going to be really ideal typical about this, is to say, here is what something looks like ideal typically when it is securitized. Now let's think about the kinds of processes that might or might not produce those sorts of outcomes. Let's talk about the configuration in particular circumstances, how something becomes an object of security policy. My inclination when it comes to thinking about states is actually not to ideal typify at that level, but to either go above or below. To think about transnational transactive processes, or to think about lower level negotiation of political authority kinds of processes, and see where the tension points between those happen. I mean, think about what the states are in a lot of ways. They're a certain kind of stabilized border for cutting down certain sorts of transactions and not others. And in order to figure that out, we need to know what the transactional background is and how these things emerge. And then if we are able to look at the state itself as a kind of standing wave in transactional processes, not ideal typifying a state, but border processes, and looking at how different border and boundary processes concatenate with each other to give rise to the effect of this thing that we then call the state. I think that's actually a much more useful way to go about it. The last thing I would sort of point to... Think about Mark Salter's work on airports. Right? Mark did this fantastic stuff looking at the way in which notions of security play out in an airport, looking at the kind of the utter powerlessness, but with full consent, of your average airline passenger who comes in and submits to all sorts of things which in other contexts would be considered incredibly undignified. Except now it's all for safety and security, so it's perfectly okay. And looking at the actions, the system of actions there, the symbology of how this is narrated, looking at those spaces and saying, how is this authority, this thing called the state, is becoming something that's an everyday presence whenever you cross that kind of border. And it's become much more intense for, was always that intense for people who are trying to cross geographical borders. It's become much more intense for people who are now in quote-unquote safe domestic space. Right, so something is, there's an interesting mutation going on in terms of these modes of control. And I think trying to cut in at those levels and disaggregating this big thing called the state into lots of little areas in which we see these modifications happening. And then that also, I think, brings into sharp relief the challenges involved in knitting them all back together, at least discursively and rhetorically, and sort of attributing them all back to the actions of one actor. And saying that, and continuing to say that there's such a thing as the state floating around in there. You would, to put this in slightly different terms, you have an older tradition where the assumption of the unitary state is pretty well established. You have a contemporary actuality of a whole bunch of different things that are very dispersed. You have tensions between the dispersion and the older tradition that everything should go together. And watching how individuals and groups play out that tension in practice, I think, is a really interesting and very understudied kind of research area. And really, if you want to look at where the state is stating itself, that's where the state is stating itself now, is in those tensions between the memory of what it was supposed to be and the actuality of what it is, the actuality of what's going on the ground right now. These are always these sort of temporal negotiations about this. None of this stuff happens purely. There's always a historical legacy that has to be negotiated with in some way. And I think, that's the last comment I'll make, I think that what I find most useful myself with trying to think this through is the notion that you get out of certain pragmatic thinkers and some of their contemporary interpreters, people like Hans Joas, folks who talk a lot about situated action, situated creativity, that we use resources that are available to us to do various different kinds of things, which implies on the one hand we need an ideal typical account of what the resources are. And then, we need a configurational account to how those resources get utilized in practice. And I think this is what the practice turn people are groping toward. I don't think they're quite there yet. I think it's what we were trying to get at with the processual relational thing. I don't think we said it quite as clearly as we could have. Or maybe we said it too clearly and it didn't make any sense. But I think that's really what we're getting at, this idea that action is socially situated and trying to figure out how socially situated action is now mutating and shifting in different ways. And so the state emerges rather than being the foundation of an analysis.
Anyone want a final question? There is room for one more. How about Leva?
All right. Thanks for a great talk, Patrick. I'm toying with, or I have this question I'm working on the development of our discipline.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me, I mean, Waltz has been repeatedly brought up here, but it also seems to me that if you look at, for instance, part of what Morgenthau was doing,
yep.
And this is goes back to the analysis of Richard Ashley as the founder of Cassini, that part of what early realism is about is sort of an idealification of what classic diplomacy was.
Yep.
18th, 19th century diplomacy. Trying to sort of,
right.
Okay, we need to now
right.
make this explicit
right.
so that the
right.
silly, non-noble statesmen of the day
right.
can make some sensible politics.
Right, and intra-European diplomacy in particular.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and of course, I mean, it's quite easy to sort of put Morgenthau in the trajectory from Weber.
Mm-hmm.
So where does this go off the rails? Is it simply the American Scientific Revolution?
So yeah,
where people start forgetting this as ideal
right.
types and start saying this
right.
is truth and not only sort of not truth in the testable way, but it's truth in the way that we should approximate.
Right.
If we're not, I mean, when right. ideal type becomes not only sort of
right.
something that we look at, not necessarily something that we test, but actually sort of reified as
right.
something that we should approximate.
Right. No, it's a good question, because I mean, I think that it's always struck me as bizarre that people didn't read Morgenthau as a Weberian, because Weber's all over that text, and in particular, not just in the 46 book, in Scientific Man versus Power Politics, which is one of the best neo-Weberian, neo-Nietzschean rants about liberalism. That's been written. I mean, Carr's critique of utopianism has nothing on Morgenthau in that 46 book, and somehow to find this person not only being upheld as the great founder of this progressive science of international relations, but then even he himself in later editions starts putting in these abstract general propositions. You go back and you look at the first and second editions of Politics Among Nations, and there aren't six principles of political realism up at the front. Those only show up, what, the fourth edition, fifth edition? It's later on in the process that he starts doing this. And I think there's two answers here. One of them has to do with just sort of biographically with Morgenthau himself. I mean, he goes to Chicago, and you know, it's hard not to be affected by the intellectual climate of Chicago at that point, which is pushing a certain understanding of social science. And what Morgenthau learns there, though, is he kind of learns not necessarily this is what I buy. He learns this is the idiom in which Americans think about things. And if you really want to speak to Americans, because this is the other bit about it, Morgenthau is really concerned to make sure that the Americans don't screw up the post-war world. It's like, oh crap, you have to do something right. You have to not mess this up. You have this great moment here. And how do I get my point across? Well, if I come in with a lot of German speculative philosophy, that's not going to go over so well. But if instead I go in and say, I have looked at world history and distilled some basic lessons for you to follow. Oh, your average policymaker who wants the one-page memo, right? Oh, good. 6 points. Cool. I like those. 6 points is good. I can take 6 points. That's easy for me to digest. I can go ahead and do that. So part of it is that desire to influence. And in an American context, the desire, this is the thing that is difficult. This is the thing that's important with this sort of sociology of IR in particular. To the extent that IR is an American field, an American discipline, an American social science, as Hoffman put it, right? To the extent that that's true, it's this particular articulation of the science politics distinction. The idea in the United States is that you exert power as an intellectual by withdrawing from politics so you can solve the problems of politics and come back and tell the politicians what to do. That's an old American notion. There are ways, if you go back to Richard Hofstadter talking about anti-intellectualism in the United States, there's a way you can sort of read this as like self-protection on the part of the intellectuals, because they had to have something, because the general culture is very anti-intellectual. So what do? You withdraw to your sort of high cave someplace, you figure out the answer, and then you come back with the answers. And given that for most Americans, there's really no difference between science and technology, so to be a scientist and come up with answers also means delivering cool gadgets. So, okay, good, I can come out and do something. Great. So whatever we're funding you to do must be okay, because now I have vacuum cleaners. Awesome. All right, so you can keep doing what you do. In order to articulate knowledge, you have to withdraw so that you can solve problems. Now, of course, Weber is the polar opposite of this. He says, yes, you withdraw from politics, but not to solve problems. You withdraw from politics so you don't accidentally dignify partisan positions with an absolute ideal of science, therefore giving power holders free license to go off and do whatever they want to do. So you withdraw that idea. Think how differently this plays in the U.S. Because in the U.S., precisely what you want to do is you want to dignify the policies you like as science. You want to be able to come out and say, no, that's the scientific way to go. That's how you want to do things. IR, as configured as a field, sort of has that in its DNA. So I think that what happens then is Morgenthau, both by virtue of being in the U.S., by virtue of his location, by virtue of wanting to speak to power holders, by virtue of this particular kind of science politics articulation, ends up sounding more like that. And certainly his colleagues and his students end up sounding a lot more like this. And so you end up with the tragic sensibility of a Weberian account of great power politics turning into a set of positive recommendations for foreign policy, which doesn't make any epistemological sense whatsoever. But sociologically, it makes sense. And then you have the same gesture being repeated. I mean, Waltz keeps coming up, right? But think about the introduction to Waltz's book. Waltz says, can I make this a real science? So I get a grant from the Natural Science Foundation. I'm going to go make this into a real science. Interestingly, he actually makes it into an analytical science, and nobody understands that. And instead, what everybody does is, let's complexify Waltz's model to make it a better instrument for prediction of whether or not we're going to have to intervene in the Middle East. You know, and Waltz is like, duh. It's not, every single time he's had to talk about this, he said, no, that's not what I meant. That's not what I meant. That's not what I'm doing. That's not it. But there's this pervasive misunderstanding having a lot to do with this American understanding of science and politics. And then, quite frankly, having an awful lot to do with the chief American exponent of this particular misunderstanding, which is Bob Cohen. And Cohen, located at a particular place, articulating a certain understanding of what social science is supposed to be, being very articulate at summing up a number of different debates and articulating them in a form that people find accessible. A lot of the way in which we read IR was systematized by a lot of Cohen's work on what knowledge should be. And Cohen is a neopositivist, unapologetically so. It's very difficult to read any of these classic figures outside of that tradition because of the power, sociologically, of that neopositivist reading of those figures. The Waltz's book sold for like $80 in the United States. It was very, very expensive. Cohen's edited volume that excerpted the first four chapters of Theory of International Politics and then some essays discussing it sold for $24.95. And it was the book that everybody read. And it's interesting what chapters he does and doesn't include from Theory of International Politics in that reader. It produces a certain understanding of what knowledge of international relations is supposed to be. So I think some of it has to do with the way in which this grew up and the way it was institutionalized in that particular twist in the 1970s, which now leaves us with the legacy of people being read against their own grain and nobody realizing that it's being read against their own grain. There is this other tradition, and we don't have any access to it anymore because we've forgotten it.
That is an interesting view of the sociology of knowledge, and particularly of knowledge within IR in the US, and it gives me the opportunity to round off with a reflection on the Norwegian situation, which is very parallel, because when the social sciences were institutionalized in Norway at the tail end of the 1930s, one of the people in the running for getting the first professorship was, or the first chair, was a chap who had studied with Weber, a certain Arvid Brodersen. He didn't get it. What happened instead was that you had stirrings of a Weberian and Durkheimian type, but then came the Second World War, and afterwards, the Marshall money.
Right.
And one of the and the Fulbright money, and one of the strings being attached, being that you would have people like Paul Lazarsfeld coming to Norway, camping out at the Institute for the Social Sciences, and spreading the happy news of neopositivism.
Yep.
So when I discussed this with the grand old man of sociology in Norway, who actually left his chair in protest, among other things, because of these things, Dag Osterberg, and he said that when he came to the Institute of Sociology, in the early 60s, he had to reintroduce Weber, because Weber had been forgotten in this sort of cloud of American money that had had been lying over the horizon.
Yeah.
And to this day, I mean, in a Norwegian setting, it's extremely apposite to go through the idea of the ideal type being science at all, because it can't be falsified, so it can't be science, right? So where did that come from? Well, we know where that came from. That came from the American.
Right.
And you could go through thinker after thinker after thinker, and you have the same thing with Durkheim. It's Parsons Durkheim that is being received, not Durkheim.
Right.
It's Durkheim.
Right.
So in that sense, your talk spoke to us in a number of ways, but perhaps also in ways that you could not possibly have known before you started. So thank you so much.
Thank you.